Notes from the Left Forum, Part 4. The conference titled Resistance was held in New York City June 2nd through June 4th. It looked at questions of power, strategy, and tactics as resistance to Donald Trump rises. The focus of many panels this year was on moving beyond Trump into an examination of the system which produced him. Part 4 of Notes from the Left Forum is drawn from the plenary Challenging State Repression. We hear from Palestinian American activist and one of the co-chairs of the Women's March, Linda Sarsour, and from artist and writer Molly Crabapple. We begin with Linda Sarsour, who gives what she says is a mom lecture for the left.
First, people were talking about, you know, we're getting going down the line, or our president might be going down the line of fascism. I mean, I don't know about everybody else, but I'd like to get on the same page. I think we're already living under fascism. That's just my personal opinion. And for those that may not be yet there, early warning signs of fascism, I hope everybody knows them, or if you should by now, very basic: disdain for human rights, controlled mass media, disdain for intellectuals and the arts as we defunded the National Endowment of the Arts, powerful and continuing nationalism, identification of enemies as a unifying cause, rampant sexism, corporate power protected, labor power suppressed, obsession with crime and punishment, obsession with national security, rampant cronyism and corruption, and fraudulent elections. I mean, we're fascism, people. That's it. Let's move on. And also for me, and I know for many of you in this room, Trump did not introduce racism to me. He didn't introduce sexism to me. He did not introduce mass deportations to me. He did not introduce Islamophobia or homophobia to me. He did not introduce anti-Semitism. Trump is just the accumulation of all the diseases that many of us have been fighting in this room, some for decades and some for centuries in this country. So let's move on from this Trump conversation, because what it does is it undermines and underestimates and forgets the horrors and years of sacrifices and communities that have been devastated by policies from the days of the foundings of this nation. So we talk a lot about what kind of movements we need and what kind of movements we need to bring back, but really the kind of movement that we need is an intersectional movement. We can't have an anti-war movement that's not talking about racial justice. You can't have a racial justice movement that's not talking about healthcare or talking about immigration reform. So, and I want to also give credit where it's due, because oftentimes we steal the intellectual property of black women, that we use this word intersectionality that was coined by Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, a black woman who said that we have to bring those different types of discriminations together and tell a whole story together. So I am asking us in the left that we understand that we have to organize together. And what we have been doing for a really long time is that we've been sitting in different corners of the room, the environmental justice people doing what they want to do. We got the ending police brutality people over here, and then we got the people talking about healthcare is a human right, and we're talking trans rights and LGBT crisis. We're sitting in all different corners of the room. But what we need to do is build a movement that brings us all to the table. Don't ask me to leave out any part of my identity. Don't tell me don't come to a room and I can't be a woman, I can't be a mother, I can't be Palestinian, I can't be this, I can't be that. I want to show up in all of me. And Audre Lorde said this. She said, we can't have single issue struggles because we don't live single issue lives. So the left needs to start understanding that the only way to organize is intersectionally. And if we're not building an intersectional movement, then we're going to continue to lose like we've been losing for a long time. Now, people will say, but you know what, Linda, we've won in some places. You've won some battles, but oftentimes when we win in the left those small battles, you are winning them on the backs of other communities or by throwing other people under the bus. I want to be part of a movement that loses with dignity and principles, because winning is inevitable. And when we win, I want to win together. I want to win united and in solidarity. And I do not want to win in a way that leaves any communities behind. We also have to own in the left that even within the left, yes, in the left there is racism. Yes, in the left there is anti-Semitism. Yes, in the left there is Islamophobia. So we too are not exclusive of the very diseases that we claim to be fighting outside of the movements that we are a part of. We also, as the left, as the progressive left, have to understand and learn how to disagree. What we do to each other in the movement is immediately when we don't agree with someone's position, we don't try to engage them in a dialogue to understand their experience or where they come from or why is it that they hold that particular position. Immediately what we do in the movement is we crucify people who are our sisters and our brothers because we'd rather go online and take them down instead of understand them and try to educate them and build them back up. That's not the kind of movement that I want to be a part of. Now, in a lot of the parts of the left, and this is not a criticism of every single individual that is in the left, I'm talking about just in general. Oftentimes when I'm in spaces, people are talking about different issues, and I think to myself, okay, so y'all want to talk about Syria. All right, let's have a conversation about Syria. Where are the Syrians at in this conversation? You want to talk about Palestine? You want to know what the Palestinians want? Where are the Palestinians at in that movement on that table? You want to tell black people how to run a movement? Where are the black people at? We have to understand that when we pick up on issues, that those who are the most directly impacted need to be centered because those closest to the pain are also closest to the solution. You know, something we also don't do often in the left is sometimes I walk into a space and I look around. And I ask myself a very simple question that we need to all ask ourselves. Who's missing at this table? Can't have an anti-war movement and look around the table and you got 25 people trying to organize anything and there's no black women at that table. Or there ain't no Muslims at that table. There ain't no Latinos at that table, undocumented people on that table, women at that table. We have to understand that we need to create spaces that are reflective of the country that we live in if we want to say that we are the true face of America. So when we are organizing, when we are thinking about creating those committees, or we are thinking of putting together a platform that is supposed to be reflective of all of us, then all of us need to be at that table. So when the Women's March on Washington was getting organized, you all know the story, it started out with white women. We could have let those white women organize the Women's March on Washington. They would have done a great job, and they would have probably got millions of people to come out and have a march on January 21st. Why did women of color join that effort? Because I wasn't about to let white women have a march and put out a platform and say that this platform represents all women in America. That our voices as women of color, as Muslim women, as black women, as Latina women, as Asian American and Pacific Islanders, as LGBTQI communities, we had to be at that table. And when we came to that table, we put forth the most intersectional platform that our generation has ever seen, a very bold platform where we all saw ourselves in it. Was it perfect? No, it wasn't. But it was a lot of progress from what we have seen for a really long time. So that's the importance of diversifying the movements that we are a part of, because then what happens is more people see themselves in the movement. Sisters and brothers, we can't keep preaching to the choir. We're not enough. We are not enough. And this reminds me that the choir too needs to practice singing. Oftentimes, you know, we are like, oh, we're so intellectual, we already good on this, we got good politics. That's not enough anymore. Being intellectual is not enough for the movement. Your intellectualism will not protect me if an officer comes to my house or if there's a sweep of Muslims in this country. Your degrees, your books that you have written will not protect my family, just like it did not protect Japanese Americans in these United States of America. I'm sure that when Japanese Americans were interned in this country, I'm pretty sure there was a room full of people like you that was like, this is outrageous. I'm pretty sure there were people sitting back at home being like, wow, man, this is really bad. Like, I don't agree with this. From the comfort of their couch, from behind that kitchen window while they saw their Japanese-American neighbors and their children be dragged off and put in camps on this U.S. soil. So what you have to understand is that we're not enough. And that I, as a Muslim American, what makes me more honorable than a Japanese American? Do I love my children more than Japanese Americans love their children? Do I have a job that is more honorable than the jobs that Japanese Americans had? What makes me think as a Muslim that I'm going to be immune to a horror like Japanese internment when I live in a country that massacred indigenous people, forcibly enslaved black people, engaged in segregation and in mass incarceration and mass deportation, not under Trump, but under the Obama administration? So... People will say, no, Linda, that's not going to happen. You know, what? They said, oh, Muslim ban, that was just campaign rhetoric. You know how it works in politics. They just want to get votes. They weren't even a week in, and they was already trying to ban the Muslims, just like we banned the Chinese at one point in our history. So what I want you to understand is that we have to build a collective movement that is about asking ourselves a question. What are we each individually willing to risk for the other? Are you ready to take the leadership of black women who are telling us we must love and protect one another, and that is an act, not just a mantra or a chant that we use in the movement? Are you ready to be on a train like Ricky Best and Talson and step in for a young black woman and her Muslim friend and lose your life because you wanted to stand up against injustice in a public space? Are you ready to do that? You know, we also got to question the way we operate in the left. Y'all be using words that people don't understand because we are talking only to each other. If my Palestinian immigrant mother does not understand what you are saying, then you ain't doing it right. So when you're all talking about heteropatriarchy, I don't know what, I'm going to give you an example. I did a little research on my own. I went up to random people in the street one day just because I wanted to see if I was the crazy one. I asked people, hey, you know, I keep hearing this word. I don't know what it means. I'm just wondering if you know. Please define neoliberalism. I swear to God, I challenge you to do this so I'm not the only crazy one. Either people told me they really didn't understand what neoliberalism was, or they thought it was actually something good. They're like, well, it sounds like, I don't know, something liberal, like it sounds pretty progressive. So what I'm saying to you is that we have to use accessible language, that the people that we are trying to bring into our movements have to understand what you are saying. They have to relate on a very deep and universal and personal level. So you could be intellectual all you want, and you can have conversations with the people that are around you, and that's cool, and I'm not saying not to use those words, but I want you to understand that we got to get deep into these communities. Communities who English is not their first language. Communities who don't have 28 master's degrees and may not even have a high school diploma. People who have literacy rates that are maybe sixth grade level. So let's start talking the language of the people. And let me tell you why the opposition gets a little farther sometimes than we. They simple. Make America great. Who don't want to make America great? I want to make America great too. It's what I try to do every day when I wake up in the morning. So we got to start using language about that brings people together and lets us see each other in one another. So accessibility of language in the communities that we are trying to organize is key for us to make this room 20 times fold in the left. And I specifically want to talk to my white allies. We got to get our cousins. And white folks got to get your cousin. Because a lot of us in this room, and I don't consider myself to be white, I'm a very proud woman of color as an Arab woman. It is the U.S. Census and the government that said I was white, and I'm not about to let the government tell me what kind of race I am or what kind of woman I am. But for white folks in this room, oftentimes you may be progressive and on the left, but you got family members who ain't progressive. So before you start trying to tell other people how to organize, let's start having those courageous conversations in the families and communities that we come from. Because it is often those that we love that vote against our special interests. Now, self-righteous politics. Let's be real. the left engages in self-righteous politics. The kind of politics that I want to engage in is called collective liberation. Sometimes I have to make a decision and make a judgment call at that moment. I might think to myself, you know what, I'm not really feeling this decision right now. It's not really my personal decision that I would make. But you know what? I'm thinking about black people. I'm thinking about Muslims. I'm thinking about LGBTQIA communities. I'm thinking about the most marginalized communities who have already been on the chopping block in this country. And under an administration like this one, they just got higher up on the list of those who are going to be the first to go out once this administration continues the work that they are doing. So what I'm saying to you here is sometimes it ain't about your individual politics. It ain't about you on an individual level. Are there going to be moments where you are willing to show up in a space that ain't about you, that's about black people, that's about Muslim people, that's about undocumented people? So we gotta understand that if we are truly in a movement to uplift all of us, that we have to understand that sometimes we gotta put our little self-righteous, one-issued politics to the side and understand that a decision may actually save another community or even save an individual. We have to multiply the left times 20,000 folds. And that we have been a great choir and have done and raised awareness on many issues. The time for raising awareness is over. It's very clear to me what the problems are. The time for now is mass mobilization. The time for now is mass organizing, door knocking, making sure that we are going to the most downtrodden who are not actually at the front lines of these movements in the way that they need to, because they also don't have the accessibility to be here. That when we are talking about organizing, that we, those who have some means, are putting our money where our mouths are, that we make sure that people can get to a conference like this if they can't get here, even if that means that we buy them a Metro card. And that if we're going to Washington, D.C., that there are buses that are taking those from the corners of Brownsville to the corners of South Brooklyn to the corners of the Bronx, that they too get access to the very movement spaces that have oftentimes been movement spaces of elitists who know big words and have big degrees and know how to talk about important things. Let's remember the most important people are poor people, working class people, people of color who need to be centered in the movement that we claim to be a part of.
Palestinian American activist and one of the co-chairs of the Women's March, Linda Sarsour. And you're listening to Notes from the Left Forum, Part 4, drawn from a plenary challenging state repression. Next up is artist-writer Molly Crabapple. She begins her talk mentioning 214 were arrested on the January 20th protest during Trump's inauguration. They were rounded up and charged with felony rioting. It's important, she says, to make sure no one else is locked up for their politics. Here's Molly Crabapple.
4 months. It's been 4 months since the Tangerine Mussolini ascended to the White House. 4 months of attacks on the press, of fascists in the streets, of mothers of all bombs being dropped, of moms locked in immigration detention centers, and of climate agreements torched. 4 months of a news cycle that ping-pongs between horror and stupidity. 4 months during which our main prospect for salvation lies in the Trump regime's own blithering incompetence. 4 months of Steve Bannon's face. 4 months this bad, and it is easy to think that everything is doomed. And sometimes I let myself imagine a future where the last survivors are standing on the last meter of landfill that has not been swallowed by the rising seas. And they are screaming at each other in an endless circular argument, "You should have voted for Hillary. Bernie would have won." It's a pretty picture, right? Now, if we want to avoid this grim meat hook future, the first step is realizing where we are. Trump might be the worst president we've ever had, but he isn't new. The deportations, the dead civilians, and the crony capitalism are all part of a system created by Democrats as much as Republicans. All reinforced by adult bipartisan voices in respectable, badly cut suits. Our president, send them all to jail. Our president is working within an infrastructure bequeathed to him by past administrations, Democrat and Republicans. Remember, Trump is not a builder. He is not a builder of skyscrapers and not of gulags. He just makes money licensing his name. And you know what else isn't new here? What isn't new is Trump's authoritarianism. Now, Trump might be a soft little rich boy, but he is a bloated pea in the Duterte, Erdogan, Putin, Orban pod. Trump is just following a trend towards fascism. Under pressure, countries are turning inwards. They're turning towards strong men, looking for someone to blame. They are dropping bombs and hardening borders, launching raids and building walls. And maybe the only thing that is unique about Trump is that he's all stick and no carrot. He seeks to destroy those aspects of the state that might help its citizens while bolstering the state's prisons, its deportations, its repression. And even those Pepe-loving brown shirts in the streets aren't unique to Trump. They're the same sort of fascist barnacles that demagogues always gather around them. The same legions of violent men and women with nothing to offer the world but their victim complexes, their unflattering flag-themed costumes, and the sticks that they smash over protesters' heads. Trump follows an old playbook. He hammers away at the false dichotomy beloved by all of these strutting, puffing strongmen. Like him, they divide their countries into the real people and the fake people. The fake people, that category, usually encompasses ethnic minorities, impoverished refugees, or decadent urban elites. The real people? Now here the trumpets paint a fine picture. The real people are the supposedly decent, humble, pious, patriotic. But most importantly, they are the silent, or were silent, until the moment that the authoritarian stepped onto the stage. And at this point, they exist primarily to stand and clap behind him. They wave the flags. He is the voice. You, the American people, are our last line of defense against the media's hit jobs, Trump wrote a few months ago in one of his daily money-hustling emails. The media are not the people. The people who didn't vote for Trump, they're not actually people either. We in this room, we are not real people. We are fake, 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 every last one of us. We do not exist in the Trump world. Now here I want to talk about my own profession for a bit. I am a triple fake. I'm a New Yorker, I'm a journalist, and worst of all, lowest of all, I'm an artist. To the authoritarian, artists are never real people. We are always part of that fake, impure, decadent, and disgusting elite. Now, authoritarians, and Trump is an authoritarians are liars. But like most good liars, they flavor their bullshit with a grain of truth. Historically, artists and power have gone together like butter and bread. We are the gilders of lilies, the court painters of Versailles. All too often, artists have been like Fabergé egg makers, pretending to be revolutionaries. We say a lot of liberal things, and sure, but we exclude the vast majority of people just by the language we use, the rooms we stand in, the ticket prices we charge to enter. For art to mean anything, it cannot spend all its time playing into authoritarians' greatest trope. Artists cannot ensconce themselves in wealthy or liberal enclaves. They cannot cede public space to the bigoted, the idiotic, and the craven. Art must go out into the streets, and it must speak to all classes of people in all sorts of communities. Art must be both a refuge and a weapon. Some of the best art is threatening art, but art threatens no one as long as it is entombed in safe spaces where only those who agree with it will see it. Worse, as long as it stays there, it remains inaccessible for those isolated rebels who need it most. Art needs to be out in the world, whispering, seducing, mocking, instilling us with empathy, showing us the world that is far more complicated, far more painful and dazzling than we ever could have imagined. And maybe you think now that I'm putting too much responsibility on art. After all, these are dangerous times. The pen is not mightier than the sword, let alone the predator drone. Our books do not stop bullets. Paintings cannot draw their way through prison bars. But as disappointment and violence spread, the antidote is a generosity that art, at its best, can inspire. Because art is hope against cynicism, creation against entropy. To make art is an act of both love and defiance. And though I'm a cynic, I believe these things are all we have. And what I say here for artists goes for everyone. There is no space now for retreat. Either we confront not just Trump, but all that he represents, the authoritarianism, the racism, the misogyny and kleptocracy, or we will be dealing with creatures far worse than Trump later. In a chaotic, interconnected, and rapidly shifting world, many people want two things. They want identity, and they want daddy. They long for a leader who promises not just to keep them safe, fed, and emotionally validated, but who says that he will accomplish these things by punishing the imagined other, the impure, foreign, unreal source of all his homeland's humiliations. And this Trump provides. Trump, a man who cannot govern, is in perpetual campaign mode. He pouts his lips and whips up his crowds against the other. And violence, state or freelance, becomes his defense of the modest, good, forgotten, real American majority. Now, of course, this silent, real American majority doesn't exist, and neither does this other. They're stock figures in an authoritarian's playbook, substitutes for solutions in our complex, impure, and interwoven world. Economic justice is just the first step to beating fascists, orange-colored or otherwise. But the second step? The second step is we need to fight for each other, every last one of us. And I don't mean here to tolerate, like one tolerates a pair of painful high heels, but to proudly say that this world belongs to all of us and that we are not going anywhere. Ethno-nationalists are escaping from neoliberalism's cracks, just as they crawled forth from the rot of 19th century empires, and they are singing the same false and bloody tune. On the page, in art, on our walls, and on the streets, we must write better stories. Our moment is now.
You've been listening to Notes from the Left Forum, Part 4, with activists Linda Sarsour and Molly Crabapple in a plenary called Challenging State Repression. You can find out more about the Left Forum by going to leftforum.org. The conference was held in New York City from June 2nd through June 4th at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. This program was produced with assistance from Jeannie Hopper and the Left Forum. Linda Perry, WBAI News, Pacifica Radio, New York.